Coming up, a special episode of the Ideas Lab podcast, What It Means to Be, presented by Dr. Yan Wong.
Hello and welcome to this Ideas Lab Predictor Podcast special edition on what it means to be sustainable. We've got four guests here, and they're definitely making a positive impact on the environment of this studio, so let me introduce them. From Birmingham City Council, we have Climate Change and Sustainability Manager Nick Grayson.
Hello there.
And from the University of Birmingham, we have Ben Cowan from the Human Computer Interaction Centre.
Hello.
Dr. Nicole Metier from the School of Civil Engineering.
Hello.
And Dr. Caroline Chapin from Birmingham Business School.
Hello.
Fantastic to see you all. Now, this is a massive topic, isn't it? Sustainability. How do we start? Energy, biodiversity, reducing production, pollution. What's the most critical? Or do you think we should go for the biggest impact, fastest impact first and tackle the tougher stuff later? What? Ben?
I think one of the most prominent aspects, I suppose, for us as well, is the most common thing that people think of, I suppose, is electrical energy consumption in the home. It might not be necessarily the biggest cause of sort of carbon emissions, but it's the one that people have closest in their minds, I think, to some extent. So I think that's probably one that we look to tackle first, even though it's not necessarily the biggest one to tackle, I suppose. But.
Caroline?
I suppose from my point of view, it would be more like transport, actually, because today it accounts for around 35% of all energy consumption in the UK. So I would put the focus there.
Nicole?
I think it just depends also how you measure sustainability and what the word sustainable means. I think there are over 100 definitions of the word of sustainability out there.
We'll be here for a while, then.
Yeah, yes. So it just depends. I mean, at the end of the day, you're looking at the so-called three pillars. So you look at economy, you look at environmental and at social impact, and you try to optimise between those. So it depends which one is the most important for you is where you start to some extent.
Nick?
Yeah, it's definitely something around balance. That's really what it comes down to, a more balanced way of living, and balance being that it's imbalance with the environment. And the reason why we're living an unsustainable life at the moment is that our consumption patterns, be it energy, be it products, be it food, are completely outstripping the world's ability to support us. So that's why it needs urgently looking at.
I think there's a really important point in that, actually, about how looking at indirect energy use, I suppose, as well, looking at sort of products and consumption as well. I think that's sometimes a thing that's forgotten about by the general public.
It's a whole lifestyle.
Exactly.
That's
it's
exactly
a lifestyle
where we're
thing.
At. And, you know, some parts of the US, we're consuming something close to seven planets at the moment in terms of lifestyle choice. Parts of Europe, it's three. Well, the last time I looked, I think we've only got the one. So we need to do something about it in order to rectify that approach.
Well, we went out and asked some people that we met what they did to try and live in a sustainable way, so we could listen to them.
Well, my carbon footprint is very low because I don't drive.
I recycle.
Recycling. Don't print things off the printer when I don't really need them.
I recycle.
I try and recycle as much as possible.
I crush my cans. I clean them and crush them and store them.
I don't own a car. I use either public transport or I cycle everywhere.
Public transport.
I use public transport.
Try and walk places rather than use my car or get the bus.
I make a point every night of turning off all the electric.
Buying food that's been sustainably sourced.
That's pretty much what I do.
Probably that's about
so
it.
So there was quite a lot of transport in there, wasn't there? And recycling, I guess.
I think there was. I mean, certainly in terms of transport, I think it very much depends on what's available and how you can use it.
Yeah.
I mean, we quite a few people around the table cycle or walk. And I mean, I come from Germany where there are more cycle paths available. So I would actually cycle much more in Germany than I do here, whereas I'm much more likely to take the car. I've got a car. Normally it's we call it a weekend car because that's when we use it. There are some routes which are just not nice to cycle along, even though distance-wise they are actually not that great and it could be done. Whereas in Germany, I'm quite happy to cycle 15, 20 kilometres one way. Whereas here it's sort of not so nice. So I think if the availability is there, then it makes you change your ways as well.
I mean, especially with the cycling, I mean, I don't know what it's like in other cities, but in Birmingham, it's bit of a death trap sometimes to go around, you know. And I think there is something to do with infrastructure and to do with sort of the council giving that infrastructure. And also same thing with bus services. If they're frequent and they go to the places where people want to go and they're clean and they're sort of, you know, people enjoy that experience, they'll hopefully use them a lot more. Whereas sometimes that's not necessarily what you experience when you experience those sort of services. And I think that's a big barrier for people. Actually, we never do.
And I think the good news is. I'm glad we got some good news.
Coming from the council.
That we're just preparing an urban mobility plan,
oh,
which is very much about connecting all those different elements of service. And obviously, there's a whole load of reasons as to why transport in Britain isn't the same as Germany or Holland or anywhere else. But that's a whole political debate, really. Mm. But one of the other very significant factors we've got in Birmingham, which we're going to want to exploit in the future, is that you wouldn't believe it because we haven't got a major river, but we've got 400 kilometres of urban brooks. Now, most people don't even know where they are or what they look like. But when we have these intense storms, suddenly they become a flood zone for the city and cause significant disruption. Whereas actually they provide a literal blueprint for a future walkable, cyclable city. So we've got to work with that natural infrastructure. Can't engineer your way out of that. It wouldn't be affordable to do so. And also what comes with that is a whole load of water quality issues, which again, we have directives to meet. So we bring all these different elements together and suddenly you're working towards joined up solutions, which again is very much the message behind sustainability, that actually it can't be owned by one part of the puzzle. And part of the problem over these past sort of 20 years when it's been trendy is that everyone's assumed it was an environment problem and that sustainability was to be owned and solved by the environmentalists, whereas actually it's fundamentally an economic issue. Mm-hmm. And it spreads across all aspects of life in terms of behaviour and everything else. So we need to approach it in a totally joined up way, not have it owned by single elements.
There is also a question of preferences, actually. I mean, offering the cycle paths and the walking and the public transport is important, but you also have to try to influence people to actually use those. So it's about the supply and the demand as well.
Absolutely.
So in UK, one of the big challenges, actually, we have very important car ownership. It's one of the most important following actually the USA in Norway in terms of the OECD country. So actually putting the price right is also very important. And also, you know, we need to challenge that in terms of, you know, gas, but also parking. And I mean, in the UK, the highway system is free. So there is actually no incentive to use alternative mode of transportation outside of congestion.
Well,
so this is important.
Petrol prices taxed. I mean, playing devil's advocate here, are taxed quite a lot more than they are in the US and in other countries. So there is a disincentive to drive there if your petrol prices are high.
It's not one solution. That's one of the issues. You need to make sure you have the public transport available, the biking and paths and walking made it easy, but also put more kind of a price higher in terms of gas, buying a car, insurance, but also using the road, which is one of the big challenges in terms of congestion.
And it wouldn't be very popular.
It wouldn't be popular.
True.
Which is a problem, I guess, if you're a politician.
But again, also in terms of choice, is to offer low-carbon solutions to those means of transport.
Do you feel other places have got it right? I mean, I know anecdotally, for example, the bus network in London, where I come from, is a lot better now than it used to be, I think, anecdotally. And similarly, people are cycling a lot more in major cities around the UK. I get that impression. Is that true? Do you think it's on the up, as it were?
I think it is on the up, and I think the demand for it is on the up, but it has to come back to that point of safety. You know, the Maslow's hierarchy, that's your first point, isn't it, as you exit your door. Is it actually safe to do so? So that's the point of the infrastructure has got to be right.
I think there's a perception, or misperception, I suppose, of the risks to cycling, I think. I mean, I was reading something recently that suggests that people think it's extremely dangerous, but actually it's quite a safe form of transport, really. I mean, I think there's a perception in the public that it might be more dangerous than it actually is.
Well, and part of the problem is that our roads haven't been designed to accommodate cyclists, so we're trying to retrofit them with bits of coloured paint, which as a cyclist doesn't give you a great deal of confidence.
No, it doesn't.
So, you know, you against a 44-ton truck, it's, I go up the pavement, you know, it's rather than holding my ground. But that's the beauty of the other alternative, is if we've got this literal blue print for the city of all these other urban brook courses and everything, most of those are off-road and they are linear by their nature and connected by their nature. So you've also automatically got the potential of linking these things up and connecting neighbourhoods. But that's because you're looking at an asset in a positive way, whereas for many, many years, that's been viewed as a completely negative thing. They've been drainage channels. They've been things that we wanted to shift water out of the city as fast as possible and build as closely to as possible because they're preventing us from building. Whereas actually this whole shift in climate change and everything else is bringing us to a point where we have to rethink cities. We can't afford to build new ones, and we have to retrofit the existing ones to work as best as possible.
It must make a bit of a difference that people are moving into urban areas in general now, that, you know, it's a very different sort of sustainable lifestyle that you can live if you're in an urban centre. You can cycle places, you don't necessarily need to use the car or this sort of thing, than if people were living sort of very dispersed out in the countryside. I don't know if that makes any difference to how we do sustainability.
It does, but at the same time, there's also initiative in the UK by the government and the last 10 years, for example, to try to, you know, small cities or cities where actually car is dominant, to actually try to reverse. For example, in Darlington, Darlington was one of those kind of demonstration town for Department for Transport. And they really were very proactive in trying to solve the issue around cars. So they had a wide consultation with the population, you know, was a nappy about, you know, a lot of car congestion and everything. And actually they managed to promote bike and to promote walking. And in a kind of couple of years managed to shift a couple of like 6-7%, which is quite important when you're thinking about it in countries like the UK, to be able to shift that. So yes, urban area are important, but you know, there is a lot of small cities as well where having a public transport system is much more difficult in terms of investment. So you can actually try to go for green moves as well.
And other sustainability issues, as well as transport, there must be quite a lot of energy usage and things like that.
Well, and I think still one of the main things is electrical energy consumption in the home. I think it's one of the things that we can do something about. I mean, from our perspective in computer science, we're looking at ways of trying to design apps or design sort of visualizations or technologies that actually help you to act more sustainably or do not do your bad behaviors that you do in terms of energy consumption.
I guess there are sort of people might see some things as barriers to having a sustainable lifestyle, where it would actually be quite easy to remove those barriers and just make it a little bit easy for them. What do the people we spoke to think the barriers are to a more sustainable lifestyle?
Money. With more money, you can afford to have a bigger garden so you can grow your own veg. Money is the big issue.
It's difficult and it's expensive, so I think that's a major barrier.
In busy places, there's not as many options to be sustainable. There's not as many recycling bins. When you're rushing around town, you don't necessarily have the time to stop and think where the lid of your coffee should go, which bin the cardboard cup of the coffee should go, and things like that.
Time, yeah, there's not enough time to do a huge amount more. The grassroots volunteers work or anything like that.
It's very hard to try and buy products with less packaging.
Overfishing. The mindset of the people, the nation, everyone is so... They want to drive their cars everywhere. Everything we do is so energy intensive and food intensive.
We are so lazy that sometimes we just don't think or we don't bother. It's happening to someone else, it's not happening to me. Look the other way.
We should all be more environmentally minded than we are, which is why we're in a situation that we're in.
It's easy to say that, isn't it? I mean, we are all naturally lazy. I'm not sure that's going to change that much. But maybe there are things that you can do to make it easy for people to overcome those barriers, to make it obviously cheaper to do something. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that was touched on in the clips was that barrier of time. That's a big cost for people in terms of doing these things.
Presumably computers must help a lot with that. I mean, I can get my smartphone out and suddenly work out when the bus is coming or when the train is coming, and I don't need to drive a car if I can do it in the next 5 minutes.
Definitely. I mean, that's one of the that's one of the big revolutions with sort of looking at sort of smartphones and sort of portable computing, is that you can actually get that information very, very quickly, and you can hopefully act on that information as well in a portable way. So it's a fantastic sort of development to try and sort of push people towards more sustainable behaviours. But I mean, there's an element with, especially with the applications that are designed for this, so in terms of visualising your energy use with graphs and such things, information is sometimes not enough. It's trying to sort of nudge or to move people into certain sort of ways of behaving, whether that's using social norms, whether that's creating barriers to certain behaviours or such things. Yeah, I mean, those are the ways that I think can be really high impact.
Do you try and do that in the council, Nick?
there's a whole division of nudge, but it's not called nudge. But of trying to sort of encourage people to do things differently, and it's providing the right facilities in the right place, or adapting your services to suit demand and lifestyles. It is all around behaviours, yes. Sustainability is fundamentally about us living in harmony or in balance,
maintaining equilibrium
with our environment. And it's the fact that somehow or other, cities have come about in a certain way and to serve a certain function. But this is why we, with the science we've got now, we need to re-examine them.
You might find it difficult to re-engineer humans not to want to live in cities, though. I think that's a sort of global phenomenon, isn't it? And I don't know if there's engineering things that you can do to help out people in cities.
Personally, I would actually prefer living in a city. Then I'm a city person, so I really like having everything close and not be having to use a car to go to the supermarket, to go to the cinema, and that everything is within at least cycling distance, maybe not necessarily walking distance for me, but cycling distance, that's what I enjoy. But I mean, Birmingham is actually, as a city, is probably not that bad because it has quite a lot of green spaces, has got a lot of parks, has got the canal system, has got the brooks. So, I mean, the canals are, there are more kilometre canals in Birmingham than there are in Venice.
In Venice,
so,
I've heard.
Yeah. So it's always the same one. And so they are, I think Birmingham is actually quite a pleasant place in that respect. There are facilities out there. But I think, coming back to the clip, I think there were two things that kept repeating were time and money. And I think certainly the way work goes these days for a lot of us, where you're at work for a long period of time, when you come home, the last thing you want to do is spend time on being more sustainable. So if it's something that's easy, I mean, recycling in Birmingham currently is reasonably easy. According to the last Forward magazine from Birmingham City Council, it's becoming slightly less easy because, if I interpret this correctly, but Nick will correct me if I'm wrong, is that you have to pay to have your green rubbish taken away, whereas at the moment it's taken away every 2 weeks. And you can put out as many sacks, green sacks, as you like, and it's taken away. So I've got a garden, I've got a compost, so I can compost some, but not all of it. So this is now requiring me to drive to the tip if I don't want to pay for the 240-litre bin or whatever it was. So that's then somehow no longer sustainable for me. It's time-consuming. It's if I take the petrol, it's money-consuming. And it's making me less likely to want to do it.
The public sector has certainly a role to play. I mean, government do impulse quite a lot in terms of society. But what I find interesting at the moment is with the kind of the retirement a lot of the baby boomer, you can actually, that they have the time, they have less the money. So actually there is a kind of increase in community gardens and self-gardening and producing your own food and everything. And I think that's quite an interesting phenomenon. Also in terms of being able to live in city, but actually having this kind of more gardening and more sustainable kind of way of growing food. So I think there are different trends and patterns at play.
I should play devil's advocate here, I feel, because it could be argued, I imagine, that gardening in your allotment is actually less sustainable than getting some farmer to do a load of stuff in large scale in a field. And similarly with recycling, is that the right issue to concentrate on? Is recycling inherently a sustainable thing, or do we end up just shipping lots of this stuff out to Africa to be sorted, or, I don't know, treating it in the wrong way?
Well, if you don't recycle, it ends up in landfill. Or as you say, you ship it out. But if we don't ship it out, it ends up in landfill, and there's limited space in
And you think that's one of the important things we should be focusing on if we're talking about living a sustainable lifestyle, is the recycling?
I think it's looking at the packaging, maybe in the first place, how the products are encased. Recycling in its own right, I think, is good, but I think you have to look of what produces the rubbish. So therefore, can you actually reduce at source as opposed to trying to recycle? I think if you can reduce at source, that's more sustainable than trying to recycle.
And I think that, I mean, businesses have got a real responsibility there. I mean, manufacturers of, you know, products and these sort of things, thinking about packaging, they've got a real responsibility in terms of creating a sustainable lifestyle. And I think at the moment, I mean, I think that they're maybe not meeting that as well as possibly could do. I think that businesses have got, and producers have got to really think about the packaging that they have and try and stop the amount of waste that we have from consuming.
Do you think that's one of the biggest environmental threats that we face? We haven't really talked about climate change, have we? And that's the elephant in the room, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, if you look at CO2 production and what as a result of which, I mean, there's so many elements to it. It's your energy, it's your car, mm-hmm. It's your inherent in your products that you use because when they produce carbon when they need it to be manufactured or so. I mean, I think that is a really key part. But again, we can do things differently. I mean, I know from the Olympics, for example, that a lot of material was transported using boats as opposed right. to on the road. And that was much more carbon efficient than using lorries.
Is it more carbon efficient on boats than on the road?
Okay.
More. Right. I didn't know that. Thank you. What do the people we spoke to think are the biggest environmental threats facing Britain?
Environmental threat. Apart from unpredictable weather.
Probably pollution.
Along the lines of what everyone's been saying about global warming, about the amount of traffic that we have, the amount of fumes that we have.
Massive part of the primary economies in places like Cornwall and Scotland. Sustainable fishing isn't growing perhaps as much as it should be, and there is a real threat, especially as seafood from the North Atlantic is in great demand a lot of the time. People need to be really careful with what we're taking from the seas.
We create so much rubbish, regardless of all the clarion calls that we're having. We're still not listening.
You know, I like the comment about the rubbish. I mean, I've got a colleague within the school who basically produces one black bag a year mm-hmm. and nothing else. Yeah. But that he can do that because it comes down to money, it comes down to time or so. The way his family is structured, he can do it where he lives. He lives in a big house with a big garden where he can compost things. Lives in a village where there are still butchers, where there's still greengrocers, so you don't get your stuff packaged. You mm-hmm. literally go to the butchers with your plastic tub, get your whatever steak or whatever you buy, sausages, put in that plastic tub, so you don't have that packaging. You go to one of the bigger supermarkets here, and everything is double or triple packaged or so, mm-hmm. but it comes down to time and being possible to do that.
And the packaging has a large environmental impact when you... If you don't recycle it, if you just landfill it,
I think it's an element of, you know, I mean, the CO2 that's used in terms of producing those sort of things. I think it's especially it just seems mm-hmm. sort of very, very wasteful in terms of if you don't need to use it at all. And that I think that's the point. It's probably one of the most unsustainable ways of behaving as a company in terms of packaging.
So the interesting thing is for me is whether there might be the perception that it's wasteful, but I wonder if some other things that we don't really think of very much at all are actually more wasteful in terms of producing a higher carbon footprint, for example, or other measures of sustainability, because packaging is a very obvious visual thing. But maybe, as you were saying, energy usage or transport, actually, or with the transport costs, I know I've looked at some of the figures, flying by air, your 2-3 holidays a year by air maybe contribute far more than your car. And so what do we do about that? Should we tell people not to drive a car, or should we tell them just not to go on holiday?
I think that's a big issue, but I think it's also about understanding that. For example, I thought I was sustainable because I bike. I never mm-hmm. bought a car.
Yeah.
And actually, I went on those Act on CO2 website mm-hmm. and realized that I was actually unsustainable because I was living on my own. Mm-hmm. And I was flying a lot because of my work. So there is kind of the constraint of society as well and a kind of unseen action that you're not even aware of. So I think there is also the push in terms of children and teaching people. And it's also about a choice of society. We are a society of consumption. You know, we change iPad, we change our mobile phone, we change the computer all the time and everything. So, and there is a wider debate in terms of where do we want to be, as well as the kind of economic constraint of individuals, I think.
I think when it comes to sort of flights and especially the transport and trying to get people to stop taking flights, there's an element of sometimes people are a bit inelastic about what they can do. I mean, I just thought about the point where you're saying about work, you know, sort of having to fly places, having to do certain things. Sometimes those have to be done. It's trying to sort of get people to stop doing them when they're sort of seen as more of a choice, I suppose. So, an example, not only because I'm petrified of flying, but I get the train most of the time when going up to Scotland or going up to places mm-hmm. like that. And it's trying to sort of when there's a realistic choice in terms of time or those sort of things, to try and get people to pick that more environmental, that more sustainable choice, I think.
But time is a real important one, yeah, there, isn't it? I mean, when the volcano erupted some years ago, I was stuck on my way back from skiing, which may not be sustainable at all, but on my way back from skiing, I got stuck in Germany and ended up coming over here by train and boat. But it literally took me 24 hours to do it, whereas it would have taken me 2 hours normally on the plane. And as it may have been reasonable fun at the time, and it was sort of an adventure. It's not something I want to do on a regular basis.
Yeah. These don't seem to be the low-hanging fruit. Presumably it's going to be hard to get people to stop taking holidays, although you might be able to get them to stop flying quite so much. There must be other things we can do that are easier. Are those the things that are worth concentrating on? I don't know.
I think sometimes the low-hanging fruit tends to have been attempted to have been done, and they maybe don't have such huge impacts. I mean, there's an example in the home, for instance, that, you know, I mean, lighting and sort of cooking and those sort of things are actually quite low in energy consumption. Mm-hmm. You've got space heating, for instance, one of the big things, and that's something that's a little bit harder to tackle. And there's also a bit of an interface issue there with it being quite confusing to use thermostats and things like right. that. But, you know, yeah. but there's an element of the low-hanging fruit sometimes is actually not the most impactful.
You look at the university or so, and a lot of the buildings are actually not energy efficient in the slightest. They have single glaze, they are drafty like mad, and in the winter, what do they give us? They all give us electric heaters. Well, most of the offices run electric heaters in my school, and that's the only way you can actually keep it up from about 12 degrees to anything decent. And if you have a computerized job where you sit at the desk most of the time, you need a certain base temperature because otherwise it's just too cold, and putting it on another jumper or thermals doesn't help because it's your hands that you're typing with or that you're writing with is the problem. It's not.
So that sounds like it's a question of investment.
It is a question of investment, and it's huge, absolutely mm-hmm. huge, because what you're dealing with is building stock that wasn't, again, designed with energy in mind or carbon in mind. So two potential solutions for that. One is district energy, so that you actually generate electricity at a local source. And if you do it through trigeneration, you generate electricity, heat and cooling in the same centre. And we've got three such centres operating throughout the city centre in Birmingham. And it's massively reduced our energy and carbon output from those. That's connected to the hospitals.
Is that, so that's not just the council.
It's multi-agency usage, and we have plans for far more. And then the other scheme that we have in train is we're a pilot authority, if you like, for the Green Deal, where we're targeting 29,000 homes in the city, all of which are below, or 26,000 of which are suffering fuel poverty, because the quality of the bill matches what Nicole was just saying. But they were former public housing stock in the main, but some of them are now privately occupied. And so they need proper insulation and upgrades in terms of boilers, etc., etc. But you can do it in such a way that if over a 25-year period the payback works for the level of investment, then actually there's economic sense in doing it. And we have a private sector partner plus private investment in that to the tune of £1.5 billion. So it's big scale stuff. And in fact, in terms of the future, the retrofitting of cities is the next big economic market to get launched in the world, because natural resources are getting harder and harder and harder to tap. Those companies are cash rich, and they're looking for somewhere that's actually safe investment. There's a closed loop there.
And it's sustainable to upgrade your houses is a long-term sustainable solution.
If we're going to live in cities, then having them as low carbon as possible makes absolute sense. If those companies that are actually massively cash rich at the moment, out of natural resources and their business is natural resources, then it makes absolute sense for them to co-invest in the future of retrofitting of cities. And it's happening.
We've been talking a lot about sustainability, but I imagine people are sort of getting a bit bored with being force-fed the word sustainability all the time. Are there other things that people are thinking of now? What's the way forward?
I think we a lot of the research we do is actually looking at resilience, and so having a time element into it as well. So you want to do something that is sustainable, so that takes your environment, your social, your economic costs into account, but it also looks at it what happens in 50 years' time. So you're doing something, you're making changes, like Nick was saying, to the road infrastructure, to the cycle infrastructure, maybe for Birmingham or so, but is this still okay in 10, 20, 30, 50 years or so? So we're trying to look at what might the future look like, and trying to assess what we currently do. Is that resilient, future-proof, basically? So that's quite a big big sort of key criteria now.
There's a big research program happening right here at university, but it's internationally connected, called Livable Cities, and the council are a partner in that. So are Lancaster and Southampton, because we're looking at multiple cities. But it is all about that sort of long term, definitely looking at 2050, 2080, because there are carbon targets. And we're also working with business, the Business Council for Sustainable Development, both the World Business Council and the UK, on natural capital, which is this whole dependency we have on the natural world. In fact, everything we eat, everything we drink, everything that we make our furniture out of, everything we drive our car, everything is sourced from natural capital, and yet it's missing from all our accountancy. That makes no sense. And that's why the economics of the whole situation have driven us to the point where it's a crisis. Whereas actually, if we build that into our calculations, it changes the direction of flows in the economy, and money can be made from a more sustainable lifestyle. So it's that switch that has to happen. And that is a mental switch as much as anything.
I think there's something interesting about that switch and looking at it over the long term as well. I mean, I always think about it as sort of like a fairground sort of game where you smack something down and then something else pops up the other way. We don't know what's going to happen in the future with other people's behaviours. It may be that they do something else that's seen as unsustainable. So,
Prediction is always difficult, especially if it's about the future.
Yeah.
In terms of the future, do you think everyone's positive? On a final note, is it going to be better in 2080? 2050? Are we going to be more sustainable?
Do we still care about it at that stage?
Well, we might not be.
Yes, exactly.
But the people who are around, do you have a good feeling about this?
We've seen an improvement. And if you look at transport, there was in the past a real link between your level of economic growth and your actually emission of CO2. And actually, in the last 10 or 15 years, because a lot of countries, especially in developed countries, have implemented policy, actually, we see a change in that relationship. So I just think that all those actions do have an impact. It's just how long it takes to have an impact, and is it going to be sufficient in a way?
I think it's interesting that a city like Birmingham, that built its history in industry and large-scale transport and everything else, now sees its future as a green city. Now, that's not uncommon around the world, because that is the future people are looking at, because it's the only sustainable future. And effectively, that is something for encouragement, because there's a huge urgency right now that we need to do something. But we've never had such rich information and science. We know what we need to do. We know how to do it even. So let's just get on and do it. And that's the situation we're in.
That's a nice note to end on. So Nick, Nicole, Ben, Caroline, thank you very much indeed.
This Ideas Lab Predictor podcast was presented by Dr. Yan Wong and produced by Lucy Vernal and Sam Walter. It's part of a series from the University of Birmingham.